I am an Old Testament professor, and so I always love to go back to the Old Testament. So anytime I get an opportunity to teach and I get the opportunity to choose what I'm going to teach, then I almost always go back to the Old Testament. So turn with me all the way back to Genesis. And my endeavor for today, my plan for us, I want us to understand from the book of Ecclesiastes, eventually we're going to get to Ecclesiastes, I want us to understand a theology of work. And it's a big endeavor to try to undertake an examination of a theology of work. What does that look like for us? What does that mean for us? How does God want us to understand the work that he has called us to? And Ecclesiastes, of course, has a great deal to say about this. And I want to first start in Genesis, and then we'll make our way quickly to Ecclesiastes. I'm consistently hearing a pattern when I speak to younger people. I'm consistently hearing a pattern about how they're talking about work. And it's very interesting. It's very interesting to me. I get the opportunity to engage with a lot of young people for various reasons that are thinking about career. What am I going to go into? Do I do this degree? Do I do that degree? What does that look like for me? I hear a consistent pattern where people will come, they'll ask or talk about work, and they'll say, my plan is I want to work really, really hard for about 10 to 15 years in a career that's going to pay me a huge amount of money, and then I'm going to retire really early. See, that's a great plan. That's good. I don't know that it's going to work out that way necessarily for you, but I see this pattern of young people saying this, right? I want to work a short amount of time, earn as much money as I can, so that then I don't have to work anymore. And then I hear another pattern as well. After that, or with other, I'm saying young people, but this is across the board, certainly. A pattern of people emphasizing careers as the center of their lives. They think about the work that they're going to go into, the degree that they're going to do, the career that they're going to take on. This is going to be my focus. I'm all in on this career, and it's kind of two issues that we're dealing with. Those that are viewing work as I'm just going to work for a few years, make a bunch of money, and then I don't have to work anymore. And on the other side, this idea that my career is everything. It defines me, it's who I am, and I'm going to pour my life into my career. And obviously, both of those are unbalanced, unhelpful. But I want us to think through what's a proper theology of work. And I think that this is appropriate for us, especially as men, to try to understand I don't want to just use the term balance, but what's the right perspective, a biblical perspective about work that we need to have. God teaches us a great deal about this from his word. And Solomon, in a fascinating way, helps us to understand this in Ecclesiastes. Let me start in Genesis. Genesis chapter 2. Take a look at verse 15. Genesis 2:15. Yahweh God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. That's a very simple observation. You all know this. But God gave Adam a task to do. There's both of those statements, to work it and to keep it. He had a job to do in the garden. And the first thing that we see here is that it's important for us to recognize that work is pre-fall. This is something that God institutes. This is something that God gives for Adam to do before the fall. Now, turn to chapter 3, verse 17. And I want us to, just as a setting, I think Solomon is going to pick up on this in Ecclesiastes. In chapter 3, verse 17, it's very important for us to understand, to recognize, as many of us, or all of us do, the curse that comes. Genesis 3, 17, and to Adam, he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. You shall eat of the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. What does God curse in terms after the fall? God doesn't curse Adam directly. Right? The fall comes, the man and the woman, they eat from the tree that they're not supposed to eat from. They disobey God. And the way that God responds to them, to each one of them, first to the snake, there is a curse that comes upon the snake. Cursed are you above all livestock and all beasts of the field. But he doesn't curse the woman. He doesn't curse the man. In particular, for the man, he curses the ground. He curses the ground. And that's a direct hit against his work. Because what God had given man to do was, here's a piece of ground, be a farmer and take care of it. And before the fall happens, God says, I'm giving you this, I'll say, acreage. Be a farmer, cultivate it, use the mind that I have given you to think about how you ought to take care of this parcel of land. That beautiful parcel of land just happened to be the Garden of Eden, right? That's the best farming job anyone ever had. My dad was a farmer. I very much appreciate and value farmers. I try to be a farmer myself, but I live in Los Angeles and there's no land to farm. But farming is the first thing. And when you have the fall, the curse comes upon the ground. It comes upon the work that Adam is supposed to be doing. Not upon Adam himself, but upon his work. Now turn over to Genesis 8. This is the last passage that we'll look at in Genesis before we jump to Ecclesiastes. That'll be our main focus. Genesis 8, you have this pattern in Genesis of the creation. Then you have the fall. You have the flood that comes. Obviously, I'm skipping through a whole bunch of things. And the flood is like a decreation, right? I'm going to just destroy everything. I'm going to start over again. So there's this decreation, if you will. Flood wipes everything clean. Noah gets off the ark, and now you have Noah and his family and starting all over, right? And Noah becomes a farmer. There's no other option for a career choice at that point. Noah becomes a farmer, and we know what happens. We know what happens with that. But take a look at the end of chapter 8. They're just walking off of the ark. And in I'm going to start in verse 21. When Yahweh smelled the pleasing aroma, Yahweh said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Now we initially read that verse, that verse 22, and we say, that's really nice. That's a great promise, right? God's promising, according to the scripture here, there's 1,656 years from the time of Adam until the time of the flood. And we say it took 1,656 years for God to say, I'm done, I'm wiping it out, I'm going to start over. So Noah gets off of the ark, and we still have the same sin problem. Noah walks off the ark, and we say, okay, how long is it going to take for it to happen again? and for everything to descend into chaos and wickedness and violence, and we got to start over again. And so God, after the flood, of course, is promising, I'm not going to destroy the world in the same way again. I'm going to give you time. But focus in on verse 22, and this is what Solomon is going to pick up when he explains and describes to us a theology of work. This is what he's going to pick up on. Okay, this idea from verse 22. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. What exactly is that verse saying? That verse 22, what exactly is being said here? God is saying really two things. The first is that while the earth remains. That's basically what's being said. Doesn't say how long it's going to remain. Doesn't say a duration. He just says, as long as the clock is ticking, the clock is ticking. And when the clock stops ticking, the clock stops ticking. As long as the earth remains, the earth remains. You don't know when the end's going to come, but eventually it's going to. So while the earth remains, these things shall not cease. The second thing that's being talked about in this verse is the cyclical pattern, the cycles that we see. Notice seed time and harvest. Okay, cold and heat, summer, winter, day and night. So while I have this duration of time, God says, I'm not just going to flood the earth every 500 years because the wickedness of man grows to such an extent. I'm not just going to start over every 500 years. I'm going to give you time. So the covenant, the promise made with Noah is a promise of time. I'm going to give you so much time. We have no idea how much time that is. But the clock starts. At some point, the clock ends. And in the middle, in between, is this cycle. Consistent cycles. Now turn to Ecclesiastes. You're going to see where I'm going with this. Ecclesiastes, Solomon picks up on this, of course, in Ecclesiastes. And I was talking with one of my Hebrew classes. 2 days ago on this section, reminding them about how it starts out. And I'm gonna pull a nerd thing here, okay? It's gonna be a little nerdy, but bear with me. I'm going to quote Ecclesiastes 1:2 in Hebrew. Okay, I want you to hear it. I'm sure you may have heard this before. Solomon starts out, and we know the verse, chapter 1, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In Hebrew, the way that it sounds is hevel, hevelim, amar kohelet, hevel, hevelim, hakol, hevel. And you hear the, it's exhausting. Hakol hevel. Everything is vanity. Everything is vanity. He does something so interesting here. Notice in verse 2, the way that he frames this statement, and this is the best way to start out a book. The way that he frames this statement, vanity of vanities. Now what he's saying by that construction is, I want to talk about the greatest vanity. I want to talk about the greatest vanity. One, the greatest vanity of all vanities. That's what I'm going to talk about. And your mind initially is saying, what is it? Solomon, what are you talking about? What's the vanity of all vanities? He repeats himself, vanity of vanities. And you say, what's the greatest of all vanities? And he says, everything is the greatest of all vanities. Everything is vanity. All is vanity. And you say, Solomon, how can you say that? How can that be the opening of your book? How can you start out by just saying, everything in all of life is vanity? How can you do that? and he starts talking about the pattern. He starts talking about the cycle. I'm going to skip verse 3 just for a second. I'm going to come back to it. Verse 4, generation goes, generation comes. The earth remains forever. Where have we heard that from? Clock ticking all the way until it stops. The earth remains, but a generation goes and a generation comes. Sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. That verse, that verse is very descriptive the way that he puts it. That word for hasten there means to like huff and puff. So his idea is the sun starts out and it rises up in the sky and it makes its circuit over the sky and then it dips down, and then as it goes under and as it sets, it's like it goes all the way to the beginning again. And then it starts again, rises up, enters in, and then goes to the beginning, and up, and then again. And he's just emphasizing it's a cycle, but not only is it a cycle, it's exhausting. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, around and around goes the wind. On its circuits, the wind eventually returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they go again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot understand it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. The ear is not filled with hearing. What has been will be. What has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. And he just goes on from there. The key question that he asks is that verse 3. Verse 3 is the key question. Think about his verse 2 kind of as his like thesis statement, right? Everything is vanity. And then his research question is verse 3. And he's going to spend the rest of Ecclesiastes looking at different aspects of life. He's going to say, let me explore the idea of pleasure. Let me explore the idea of work. Let me explore the idea of companionship. Let me explore the idea of riches, so on and so forth. Okay, so let me delve into this. Oh, well, this is vanity. Let me look into this. This one's vanity too. Let me look at this. Guess what? That one's vanity too. His research question is this, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What does he gain? What's the benefit of it? Now, I want to organize the rest of our time in two portions. The first portion is going to be, I'll say, a little negative. It's Ecclesiastes. It's how he sets it up, the problem. And the problem in terms of work, right? We can focus on all sorts of things when it comes to Ecclesiastes. It's a profound book, so much to be said. But we're going to focus in particular on work, the problem, the issue. He brings out some very interesting ideas in regards to how we think about work. And remember, how has sin broken the world and tainted work? And the issue is that Adam is given work before the fall. And God says, Adam, I created you for a purpose. I did not create you with an Xbox controller in your hand. I created you in order to do work. And it was perfect. It was excellent. It was exactly what Adam is designed to do, to work. And then sin comes in the world. And the question is, in what way does sin break that perfectness, that perfection? In what way does sin break that idea of work? Take a look at chapter 2. I'm going to go through a host of passages here in Ecclesiastes. Stick with me. Each one is expressing a particular issue, a problem. In what way has sin broken the concept, the idea of work? Solomon gives his own example first. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 9. Ecclesiastes 2, 9. So I became great. I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. This was my reward for all my toil. He gives his own example and he says, well, let me back up for a second. Sometimes we tend to look down, if you will, on the ancient world. Okay? And you're like, how much did you actually understand about how the world works? You know, did they really get science? How much did they actually understand? How much did they actually get? Solomon, at this point, is one of the richest people in the world. Solomon has essentially unlimited power. He can do anything that he wants. He has a host of servants at his disposal. And Solomon says, I'm going to do everything that I want to do. I'm going to do what my heart desires to do. If I want to go build a palace over there, I'm going to level that entire section and I'm going to build the most beautiful palace that you've ever seen. If I want to build this over here, I'm going to tell the people that are living there, you're out, I'm going to level it and I'm going to build it over there. If I want to take my army and march here and take this land for myself, that's what I'm going to do. And in effect, he has the opportunity to work and do anything that he wants to do. So he talks about all the various things that he accomplishes. He talks about gardens and parks that he built. He talked about palaces that he built, the houses that he built. He talks about all of the things that he accumulated, his wealth. He says in verse 7 again, this is more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. That's not just David, that's every king who had been in Jerusalem before, all the way to Melchizedek and before. A whole history, 100 centuries of time. I was greater than any king who was in Jerusalem beforehand. And then that verse 9 that we just read, I became great, I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Whatever I desired, I did not keep from myself. No pleasure that I withhold, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. Notice he starts out and he gives a straightforward statement, my heart found pleasure in all my toil. There's an element of satisfaction that's there. When he builds his palace, how much money, how many slaves, how much time was dedicated to building that palace? I grew up doing construction with my dad. I enjoy doing construction. There's something satisfying about building something, whether it's a house, whether you're redoing the interior of a room, whatever that it is. You get to the end and you're like, yeah, there's accomplishment there. There's pleasure there. There's an element of satisfaction there. Now take that idea and expound it to Solomon, who's building a palace that would have been more beautiful than I can think of. And he says, I found pleasure in all of that toil, all that work that I was doing. I found pleasure in that. That was my reward for all my toil. And look at verse 11. Here's where it breaks down. I considered all that my hands had done, the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, it's all vanity. It's all striving after wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. Here's where we have the first issue, the first problem, as Solomon's describing it. There was nothing to be gained. Now, I want us to have a clear understanding of what Solomon's doing here. Because if you were to read this passage to an unsaved person, unsaved worldview, they would say, of course there's gain. You gained a palace. That's the gain. What's wrong with that? If you ask a person, what's the profit Ecclesiastes 1:3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So you gain the outcome. If I go to an unsaved person and I say, what's the profit of all of your work that you've done? My salary. I put in this hour, I get this pay back. That's my gain. That's my profit. So how can you say there's no gain? It doesn't make sense. Solomon's not talking about, I built the palace and it's there. He's saying, I built the palace, I see it there, I took pleasure in the work that I was doing, and I came to the end and I realized that's complete vanity. That palace there is worthless. In terms of what Solomon is trying to understand for advantage, what's the benefit of it? What's the advantage of it? Because I build the palace, he'll talk about this later in Ecclesiastes, I build the palace, but I'm going to die, I'm going to hand off that beautiful palace to my son, and I have no idea whether my son's going to be a fool or whether he's going to be a wise person. At some point, that palace falls into ruin. Today, you can't go to Jerusalem and see the palace of Solomon. It's gone. It's long gone. You build a palace, and you watch it over time crumble down into the dust. You build up your strength. Over time, you watch your body decay. You seek to accomplish something, to put something into place, into practice, some new endeavor that you're doing. Just watch it over time. It's going to crumble. Solomon says there's no advantage there. There's no benefit there. There's no ultimate outcome there. It's only what's under the sun. It's just an advantage that's under the sun. But that doesn't matter. That's vanity. It's striving after wind. His example of striving after wind is a great illustration that he uses. The idea of running after the wind. You never catch it. At no point, you can see the wind's going that way, I'm going to run after it. At no point will you ever say, did it, got there, I'm done. That's his whole point. You can strive and run. It doesn't matter how fast you run. It doesn't matter how long you run. You never, ever get to your goal. You never, ever arrive at your destination. There's nothing to be gained under the sun. And we think of the example of Solomon's son. Solomon says, I built all of this. I did all of this with my wisdom. I increased all of this. I don't know if my son's going to be wise or a fool. And we say, well, we do. We know now. You didn't know. Maybe you anticipated it. But we know he was a fool. Turn to chapter 4. So the first issue, the breakdown, the problem that we have at the very beginning, when sin comes in, takes the idea of work, breaks it. Now I can't accomplish anything. There's nothing of benefit there. The next issue that he has here, Ecclesiastes 4, verse 4, then I saw that all toil, all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and striving after wind. That's a pretty bold statement. All toil, everything that's done, is just coming from a man's envy of his neighbor. The motivation that a man has in working is just because he's comparing himself with someone else. The tallest skyscrapers, the biggest companies, the you name it, is just based in a man's envy of his neighbor. I want to be better. I want to compare myself with other people. He says it's all based in that. And Solomon at times makes statements that are just across the board. It's like saying all is vanity. And in your mind you say, let me think of examples that are not vanity. Because you can't just say everything is vanity. You can't just say, Solomon, everything, all work that's ever done is just because of a man's envy of his neighbor. You can't say that, Solomon, but he does. And then your mind immediately goes to, let me think of examples that wouldn't be that case, where I wouldn't have envy brought into the equation. And I say, oh, I can't really think of examples. I can't really think of examples. That work that I did, was I comparing myself with someone else? That job that I received, didn't I have that idea in the back of my head? Oh, I got this job and not this other person, so I need to make sure that I do a really good job here because I need to shine right now. Solomon says, all that work is based in a man's envy of his neighbor. It's just the result of rivalry. Again, we're talking about under the sun. We're talking about in a corrupt world, in a world that's broken, that's marred by sin, that's fractured by sin. If you're thinking about the worldview of this world, everything that's done, from the greatest companies to the greatest skyscrapers to whatever that it is just because of comparison, just because of rivalry, just because of envy. And he says, that's vanity. Absolutely. That's worthless. Who cares about that? Who cares whether this person is richer than this person? Why does that matter? He continues on in the same chapter. Take a look at verse 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. His eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. He says, I looked around and I saw somebody, and we can all point to someone exactly like this. I looked around and I saw somebody. He's got nobody in his life. He has no one that he cares for, and he has dedicated his entire life to his career, to excelling in his career, based on chapter 4, verse 4. He spent his whole life trying to achieve and accomplish and do and perform his whole life for this. And he's got nobody. And he'll come all the way to the end and he'll have amassed a huge amount of riches and wealth and then he's gonna die. And what's gonna happen with it? Nothing. He's not gonna do anything. He's not gonna accomplish anything. This individual traded family, traded friendship, traded fellowship for career. And he comes to the end, and it's just worthless. You're going to die. You're going to hand it off to, you don't even know who you're going to hand it off to. So an individual who's alone, but yet there's no end of this individual's labor. He's just working 20 hours a day, all the time. Work, 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 all the time. Why does it matter? Chapter 5, verse 10, and I'm taking you in several different passages. I'm just looking at the issues, the ways in which work has been fractured and broken and misunderstood from his eyes, from Solomon's, as he's examining all of this. Chapter 5, verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. this is one of the best verses in Ecclesiastes. Verse 11, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Solomon is he's a genius with words. Picture this laborer who's working out in the field and he gets enough calories, right, to make it through the day, and he lays down and Solomon says, that laborer, his sleep is sweet. He worked all day, he got just what he needed, his sleep is sweet. Here's this rich man who throws a feast and eats all the delicacies, eats all the good things, enjoys all of those, takes pleasure in his wealth, and he lays down to sleep. He can't sleep because his belly is too full. And he has no satisfaction. His belly won't let him sleep. And verse 11, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. you can only drive one car at a time. This is obviously we all know, you know, very wealthy people, and I'll talk about wealth in just a second here. But we all know very wealthy people, look at all the cars that I have. Look at this garage that I built. Look at the old classics, the new sports cars, the, you know, rows and rows of cars. You can only drive one car at a time. As your wealth increases, it's just also increasing those people who are eating off of that wealth. And the only good thing is that you can see is you can just look on and just watch people consuming your wealth. You build up a company, well, you increase employees. You got to pay for employees and so on and so forth. You get the idea. Okay, so disappointment in work. He who loves money will not be satisfied with that money. And then last one that I'll turn to, chapter 6, verse 7. Chapter 6, verse 7. All the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. All the toil of a man is for his mouth. Solomon builds this picture of what work is, what it looks like within this broken world. He paints this picture of us correctly understanding post-fall, this is how work works in this world. This is the result of the fall. Thinking in terms of, I work hard, but I don't actually get satisfaction from my work, ultimately. I might build something beautiful, and initially I'm like, wow, that's great, I've got satisfaction there, and then I think about, well, actually, it's just gonna decay and turn into dust, and I didn't actually accomplish anything. I didn't actually do anything of lasting value there. If I'm thinking just in terms of the structure, everything is a result of rivalry. There's someone who's alone, but there's no end of his labor. He's obsessed with work. There's disappointment in work. All of the labor is for the mouth, but the appetite is never satisfied. You always have to eat. It's a continual cycle. And the emphasis here that Solomon has is it's cycle, 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 cycle. And those cycles within the world that God has set up in this way, after the flood, everything's going to continue. Eventually it's going to end, but it's just doing this, cycling through. Solomon is saying that makes work hevel. It makes work vanity within that system. So you say, all right, Solomon, but then what do we do? How do we have a right view? If this is the problem, if this is the issue with work, if this is the issue with a broken world, well, I'm in the world. So what do I do? How do I properly understand what work should be and what work ought to be? Now, there's several in Ecclesiastes, you know this. There's several what's called carpe diem passages. Now, I don't really like this term. Carpe diem, you know, means seize the day. As a particular term, we hear it from occasionally. Okay, carpe diem, seize the day. I don't really like that term for what Solomon's trying to do. Because when we talk about carpe diem, seize the day, usually what we mean is like, it's all worthless, so just get as much pleasure as you possibly can. That's not what Solomon is doing. That's not the theology of work that he's going to talk about. And we're going to see very clear indications of that in Ecclesiastes. So he takes generally, they're talked about as carpe diem passages. Again, I don't like that term necessarily. But Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24. Ecclesiastes 2, 24. You say, all right, Solomon, you've laid out your case. You've given the problem, the brokenness, the fracturedness, the issues. I can't actually accomplish anything outside of being under the sun. There's nothing of lasting value. There's nothing that I can do that time won't just waste away. Okay, so what do we do? There's nothing better, chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Now, what Solomon is not saying here is everything's vanity, so just get as much pleasure as you possibly can. That's not what he's saying. Notice how he phrases the second portion. This is from the hand of God. The fact that you would be able to eat and to drink and to find enjoyment, that's from the hand of God. And apart from him, who can eat? Who can have enjoyment? He sets this up as you have to understand in your work, as you're talking about satisfaction, accomplishment within a broken world, within a broken system, you have to understand God is the one who's sovereign. God's the one who's in control. And if you at any point in your life eat a morsel or drink a sip of water, that's from the hand of God. If at any point in your life you find enjoyment in accomplishing some task, that is from the hand of God. It's not you accomplishing it in and of itself. There's a huge worldview distinction there. There is a massive change that takes place. Because when Solomon is talking about under the sun, he's saying within the system itself, the word under the sun, the phrase under the sun, he's talking about within the system, within the broken system. But he says, but if you understand, God's not in that system. God's outside of that system, and God is sovereign over that system. That changes the whole perspective, changes the whole idea. Ecclesiastes 2:24, also I saw, this is from the hand of God. Take a look at chapter 3, verse 12. He builds, continues to build on this idea. I perceived there's nothing better for them, chapter 3, verse 12, nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Not only is God sovereign over the whole system, not only is God standing in sovereignty over the system, if you eat a morsel, if you drink a sip of water, it's from God's sovereignty, it's from the hand of God. Not only is that the case, but should anything like that happen, eat, drink, take pleasure in toil, this is God's gift to man. It's God's gift to man. God's not just sovereign standing up and orchestrating. He's giving gifts to man. If you ever have satisfaction, and all of us have, if you ever have satisfaction in work, if you ever have something that you take, food, water, whatever, that's God's gift to man. That is a radical change in how we're understanding, because in the world's viewpoint, in the world's system, the work is the end in and of itself. I built this company. I built this building. And I come to the end, and the building is raised up there, and it's a tribute to me. It's a tribute to who I am, my power, what I've done. And Solomon says, it's a little hilarious, because wait, and that's all going to collapse, and you're going to be dead, and you're going to be back in the dust. Pointing back again to Genesis 3. I took you from dust, you're going to return to dust. Your lifespan is this. Time of the world is this. The world stands, as Solomon is saying, it stands forever. You're this within that. What ultimate end can you actually have within this? If your goal in work is your accomplishment, Solomon is saying the only place that that ends up, the only place that that leads to is an old person all by themselves, still working hard, not knowing why they're working hard, and not giving any of their wealth to anybody that they know. He says, you have to view it as God's gift. It's a God's gift that this would happen. Take a look at chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given to him. For this is his lot. This is what God has apportioned for each one of us. However long we live, whatever that time span is, some less, some more, whatever that is, that's his lot. That's what God in his sovereignty has given to that one. The few days of his life. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. Take a look at verse 20. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with the joy in his heart. That is one of my favorite verses in Ecclesiastes. God gives him a gift in that he might work and toil and strive and be finding joy in that work because he's recognizing it's a gift from God. It's not what I'm accomplishing. It's not a tribute to me. It's a gift that God has given that I can make use of. And he says his life will just pass through his days. And he'll pass through his days with joy. He'll still come to the end. Start, stop on his life. He'll come to the end. But he says, all of those days that made up his life, it's a gift that God would give to him, that his days would be, in a sense, consumed with the work that God has given to him. He gets to be 30 years old, and he says, wow, that 30 years went by quick. Gets to be 60 years old. That went by really quick. Gets to be 80 years old. That went by quick. But I took joy in the work that God gave to me because I'm recognizing it's a gift from him. It's not my own accomplishment. Take a look at chapter 8, verse 14. There's a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. And I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. Notice the verse that comes before. I've seen it happen that a righteous man, it happens according to what ought to happen to a wicked man. Some terrible suffering comes upon him. Something horrible happens to him. He's a righteous man. We can think of Job, right? So he's a righteous man, but it happens according to what ought to be for a wicked man. And I've seen a wicked man as it ought to happen according to a righteous man. He flourishes, he prospers, he gains wealth, he lives a long time. I've seen that brokenness within the world. That's not how it ought to be. It ought to be, as Proverbs puts it, if you're righteous, if you follow God, you have long life, you have wealth, you have a family that loves you, you have children that listen, you have so on and so forth. If you're wicked, you're like chaff that the wind blows away. And he says, I've seen the brokenness that it's flipped. So he says, I commend joy, for man is nothing better than that he would eat and drink and be joyful. This will go with him in his toil. So where is the joy coming from? It's not just trying to bring about some kind of happiness because Solomon's on the border of depression. He's saying, I did all these things. I tried to accomplish all these things and I just look at it and I hate it. That palace that I built over there, it's forcing me. Every time that I look at that palace, it's forcing me to think about my end. It's forcing me to think about one day that palace is just going to fall into ruin. It's forcing me to understand and think through that problem, that dilemma, the effects of sin within the world. And so Solomon says there's nothing better for a man than that he recognize and understand his work as a gift from God, to take joy in that, to take pleasure in that. Chapter 9, verse 7, go eat your bread with joy. This is a command that he gives. He doesn't give many commands in Ecclesiastes, but he says, go eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Take a look at verses 8, 9. Let your garments always be white. Let oil not be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that's your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no working or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. This earth is an opportunity for you to work. Not only is work based on the providence of God, not only is work a gift from God, not only is work to be done for the glory of God, not for your own glory, but whatever your hand finds to do, do it, because this life is an opportunity for you to work. When we die, when we move on from this earth and we're not under the sun anymore, that opportunity doesn't exist in the same way that it exists today. It's transformed in a better way, certainly, for those that love the Lord. But there's no opportunity, or the opportunity, I should say, is different. There is opportunity today in the work that you're doing that you would correctly understand what work is, that you would be consistently thinking through every time you're accomplishing a task, every time that you're working, every time that you're trying to understand what God is calling you to, what God has for you to do, to understand it in the right perspective, according to the right lens. What is God calling you to? He does not need you to build an empire. He does not need you to put yourself on display. He does not need you to accomplish and amass a great fortune. He does not need you to do any of those things. In very simple terms, we see this taken up again in the New Testament. In very simple terms, eat, drink, recognize your work and every gift that God has given as a gift that God is giving to you, as an opportunity for you to understand God as the good giver, God as the Father who takes care of his children. And I'll end with this. Turn to chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 7. Solomon makes a switch here, and at times he makes the most provocative statements. And he says, it's all vanity, everything's vanity, it doesn't matter. I hated my life, I hated the work that I did, I hated all of that. He makes the most provocative statements. And you're like, wow, it just sounds like you're jaded against life. He's not. But the verse 7, chapter 11, verse 7, light is sweet, and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. Now, when he says it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun, he's pointing back to under the sun. It's pleasant that the gift that God has given us, the time that God has given us, however small and finite that it is within all of the cyclical patterns that we have, but it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. If a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. We live in a broken world. All that comes is vanity. And pay a special attention to verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. And initially we say, that's bad advice. Don't tell a young person, hey, just go do whatever you want to do. right? Initially, we're like, okay, Solomon, hold off there. Hold the brakes for a second. Walk in the ways of your heart. Now, my children are quite young, but I'm pretty sure that when they get to be, you know, 16, 17, 18, I'm just going to say, hey, walk in the way of your heart. Do whatever your heart calls you to do, you just go do that. But he says here, walk in the ways of your heart in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Whatever it is that you do, God will bring it into judgment. So walk in the ways of your heart. Whatever your hand finds to do, whatever the work is that your hand finds to do, whether it's a farmer or an architect, whatever that it is, all the work that we have, career, non-career, all sorts of work that we have every day, know that's a gift from God. Know God will bring you into judgment for everything that you do. Remove vexation from your heart. Put pain away from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. And then in chapter 12, he talks about what it's like to be an old person at the end, looking back. If we think about a theology of work, we all would agree with this. We have to center it in God's sovereignty. We have to center it in an understanding that any work that I have is a gift from God. It's an opportunity for me in this life to honor and glorify God, not myself. And if we even just change and think about from a biblical worldview, work as a gift from God, it completely transforms and separates us from the world around us. The world around us is obsessed with work, with money, with fame, because it's self-centered. They're obsessed with themselves. We have our focus on Christ. We have our focus on God. And our work ought to all build into that. The honor of God, the glory of God, recognizing it's all a gift from God. I didn't have time. I have to end there. But I would also encourage you, take a look at Ecclesiastes and those passages that speak about skill in work as well. Because Solomon doesn't just say, here's the problem, and then here's how you ought to view work. He also talks about skill in work. What is it? What wisdom can we gain in understanding not only what work is, but how to do work? One of my favorite passages is Ecclesiastes 10:10. Right, there's a whole host of passages in Ecclesiastes that speak to this, but take a look at Ecclesiastes 10:10 in your own time and dwell on that. I've been thinking about Ecclesiastes 10:10 for about a year now, trying to see how many times that it comes into life, and I just see it all over the place. But he'll speak about that as well. Let me pray for us to end our time. Our Father in heaven, Lord, we are grateful for the gift that you have given us. We're grateful for the gifts that you give to us. Even every day when we take a bite of food, we recognize, Lord, that you're the provider. We recognize that you are the one who sustains us. We recognize, Lord, that you have placed us within this world with the various lifespans that we have to work, to honor you in what you have called us to. You direct us in the work that you give to us. You bring these things into our lives, and we want to honor you with them. We want to be faithful to you in what you have called us to. I pray for all of us, for myself, for all of us here, that you would give us wisdom and insight to understand work in the right way, to be faithful to you, and to work with all of our might for your honor and your glory. I pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.